Hi there. This is a quick message that this podcast is general financial advice only, meaning it is not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives. We suggest you don't act on this information until you've spoken to your professional financial advisor. You'll find our full disclaimer, link to our financial services guide and website in the show notes below.
Hello and welcome to the Invest in the Journey podcast. My name is Taylor Bree Casey and I'm the Communications Manager here at Munro Partners. Today, I'm sitting down with our CIO, Nick Griffin, to recap the year that we've had in 2023 and also hear his insights and his outlook for 2024. Nick, what a year it's been. Can you detail performance for 2023 in the calendar year?
Yeah, thanks, Taylor. Yeah, so 2023 has ultimately been a recovery year for equity markets, with many markets, you know, recovering a lot of the losses that they suffered in 2022. For us at Munro Partners, across our funds, you know, we've got returns of between sort of mid-teens and mid-20% returns as we sit here on the 19th of December 2023. And yeah, that's ultimately a pleasant surprise to us. And you know, it's been a pleasant surprise, I think, to everyone that markets have recovered so strongly here in 2023.
And what were the main significant events that caused this throughout the year?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So as you went into, and you know, Jerome Powell summarised this actually just last week, as you went into 2023, you know, we were sitting at a point where central banks around the world had raised interest rates from effectively zero to 5% in the shortest space of time in history. And most people, including us, thought that that would equal, you know, a reasonable economic slowdown in 2023. And that economic slowdown would equal an earnings slowdown, which ultimately make it difficult for equity markets to perform. And what ended up actually happening is that earnings actually started recovering as early as February this year. And I think a lot of companies in the world had basically prepared themselves for the slowdown, and a lot of consumers in the world had a lot of excess savings to prepare themselves for the slowdown. And so ultimately, the slowdown as we sit here today still hasn't actually really hit yet. And so what we've seen across equity markets is a strong earnings recovery pretty much from February. And I think what this whole episode has proved to us, you know, one more time, is that equity markets, the S&P 500 is not really the economy. The biggest companies in the world are really at the forefront of human innovation, and that human innovation continues. And that ultimately what equity markets needed was just interest rates to stop going up. And so if you put the two things together, you know, 2022 was bad because interest rates went from 0 to 5% and valuations normalized dramatically, particularly in growth equities. 2023 wasn't bad because earnings didn't suffer in the way that many people thought they would. They actually recovered. And there's a bunch of other reasons for that, you know, things like AI and things like GLP-1s were ultimately driving these biggest companies to that earnings growth. And that ultimately saw the recovery in equity markets. And that was obviously a pleasant surprise for us, as it was for everybody.
And so what did the investment team do, particularly in the first half of the year, to navigate all that?
Yeah, so from our point of view, we came into 2023, you know, in a fairly defensive stance, and in hindsight, in a too defensive stance. You know, we ultimately bought into this earnings slowdown. I think if I went back and at this time of year, you go back and listen, you know, look at what you wrote last year and listen to what we said last year. And ultimately we said, you know, we thought we were near the end of this correction. We'd seen the big valuation correction through 2022, which saw, you know, the NASDAQ fall over 30% and most stocks, or the medium stock, do significantly worse than that. So we'd already had the big valuation correction and we were just trying to be patient for the earnings correction to ultimately put, at that point in time, we had roughly 40% cash in our absolute return products, and we had, you know, our long-only products were reasonably defensively positioned. What became clear to us in February in particular was, firstly, that, as I said, a lot of these companies were in a lot better shape than what we thought. You know, they weren't going to wholesale sack thousands of people and cause unemployment to go up. And then secondly, there'd been a couple of particular innovations, particularly ChatGPT had come out over December. And, you know, that sort of caught the market by surprise because these biggest technology companies in the world were uniquely positioned to benefit from the shift to AI. And on top of that, those companies had recognized that and started to invest. So Microsoft at that point in time had lifted its investment at OpenAI from $1 billion to $10 billion. They had increased their cloud capex from $30 billion to $50 billion. And every other technology company in the world was going to have to do the same thing. And so I remember it quite distinctly, actually, Taylor. We were reading all the transcripts from these companies in February, which were talking about something completely different to what we were worried about. And so ultimately we decided to invest the cash, and we decided to invest fairly aggressively through the first and second quarter. And so, and we invested aggressively into the beneficiaries of AI because we ultimately decided that this was a big shift and it was going to change how we thought about the world, and that every company in the world would have to invest in it. And so that they would invest counterintuitively of the economic cycle, and that would cause earnings to grow. And so once we recognized that, we moved aggressively towards things like high performance computing and semiconductor companies, and we moved aggressively towards digital enterprise, i.e. cloud, hyperscale cloud companies, you know, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and also towards software companies. And so we ultimately put all our cash back to work in the first and second quarter. And then we ultimately tilted the funds much more aggressively towards technology and the beneficiaries of AI. And thankfully, as we sit here at the end of the year, that's paid dividends. So those were the main changes we made.
So that's a really great summary of our long only and long short strategies. Can we maybe just focus on climate for a moment? And can you talk about how interest rates really affect decarbonisation and climate change investments? And what do you think 2024 looks like for the climate landscape?
Yeah, so thank you. So you're right. That's a good summary of what we did in the main mandates, in our key global growth mandates. And our global growth mandates have the ability to move capital around. And so as we invested heavily into the AI winners, we obviously funded that with cash, or we funded that with some of our climate holdings. Climate this year sort of had the correction that tech had the year before, if that makes sense, where a lot of the companies had sort of got a little bit ahead of themselves because of the IRA the year before. And secondly, you know, had underestimated how much the interest rate environment would slow investments in decarbonisation. And so ultimately decarbonisation investments are physical investments. Those physical investments, you know, you need to borrow money, you need money to invest in them. And from that point of view, that combined with the IRA being implemented a bit slowly, combined with valuations being a bit high at the start of the year, meant that it was a slow year for a lot of these stocks. And so they went through sort of a rolling correction. Again, that rolling correction is now coming to an end as we finish this year. And thankfully, you know, our climate fund is up mid-teens percent for the year. So we've managed to successfully negotiate that in the same way we had to negotiate it with the main funds the year before, mainly by using our stop-loss protocols that we've talked about many times on that allow us to recognise we've made a mistake. And so we've used those protocols a lot this year in the climate fund and ultimately positioned it for a good recovery in the back half of this year. As we head into 2024 for climate, there's really no reason why it can't do the same thing that that we've seen from technology stocks this year in the main mandates. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, the climate is still heating up. You know, the planet is not cooling. This problem is not solved. We still need to invest in it. And this happens all the time in growth investing. You see a great opportunity. The market valuations pull it forward. It doesn't happen as quickly as you think. Everything adjusts. But ultimately, the opportunity is still there. And we think the climate fund is set up quite well for that as we go into 2024.
Before we look too much into 2024, I just want to do a bit more of a recap of 2023. Were there any highlights for you?
Yeah, so the other highlights are obviously, you know, within the team. We continue to add to our team throughout this year. We continue to add some analysts and add across the group. And we also recruited Chow Ma, who joined us from Cooper's Investors. Chow previously had run the Asian fund at Cooper's Investors, but prior to that had been, you know, had worked in New York on global equities and on technology. And so, we're not putting words in her mouth, but she said it was like coming home to going back to doing growth investing. And so she joined us in February. And together, you know, we have formulated this small to mid-cap mandate. So we've launched our fourth fund at Munro this year, which is Munro Global Growth Small to Mid-Cap Fund. And that fund launched actually at the start of November. And it basically follows the same Munro Global Growth Investment Process, our proprietary investment process, to identify these areas of structural growth and identify the eventual winners, but only in companies below 30 billion market cap. And I remember when I spent some time trying to recruit Chow to get her to join Munro, we discussed this product, we discussed why it was important, but most importantly, we discussed that the timing for this product was so good. 2022, as I flagged a couple of times on this podcast, was a very difficult year for growth investing. You know, one of the biggest corrections I've seen since the dot-com bubble, huge valuation adjustments, no more so was that bigger in small to mid-cap stocks. And that ultimately leaves you, you know, with all this amazing opportunity set to now invest in. Interest rates are now somewhat normalized. There's a whole bunch of companies that are 50, 60, 70% off their all-time highs that are ultimately doing the right thing And a lot of their competition's now gone away. And so from our point of view, we spent most of the year populating this fund. I think we've launched it at the perfect time in November. It's up more than 10% for the year already. And from our point of view, some of the ideas we're uncovering here is exactly what we should be doing here at Munro. We should be leaning into our process to find these emerging winners that are ultimately going to turn into these much bigger winners. And so I ultimately feel that this mid fund in itself is a highlight for the year, because I know it's going to feed the larger mandates over time as well. And it really is just us extending our skill set to a broader range of opportunities that ultimately is going to help us do what we ultimately try to solve here at Munro Partners, which is to be your global growth investor and to fire those few winners that are ultimately going to drive the double-digit returns that our clients are looking for over the medium term.
And for anyone who wants to learn more about our SMID fund, we do have resources available on our website. All right, so that was 2023. Can we focus now on 2024? How are you feeling and what is your outlook for 2024?
Yeah, so obviously as we're finishing the year, it's a very strong end to the year and our funds are finishing in a strong position, and ultimately we predicted that, so we're feeling quite good about ourselves at least, not recognising the fact that we're a little bit slow in the first quarter. We're feeling a lot better about ourselves. As we go into 2024, yeah, we feel pretty good. And maybe I'll just take the opportunity for everyone to listen to step back. And I know it's hard to hear some people say that, you know, you're feeling pretty good about the world when mortgage rates are very high and geopolitics is difficult and people are struggling to pay their mortgages and earnings are slowing. And I understand that that's difficult, but in equity investing, your job is to look forward. And if we look forward, it's important to stress, you know, what a difficult period it has been coming out of COVID. You know, COVID was obviously created a cycle where a cycle otherwise wouldn't have existed. Interest rates went to zero very quickly. We then reopened. Interest rates went from zero to five very quickly. Growth went from zero to very high very quickly. Inflation went from zero to 9% and is 9% and coming back down. Supply chains locked up. You couldn't find labor. Just when you found supply and you found labor to produce the products you wanted, you know, your customers couldn't afford to buy them anymore. So this has been a horrible environment for companies to run in, to operate in, particularly physical companies. And it's been a very difficult environment, you know, for us to try and value companies when the discount rate's moving around so much. All of that's now behind us. Interest rates are effectively normalized. Central banks have managed to do this without, you know, collapsing the economy or the banking system. And that ultimately puts them in a very, very strong position, because they effectively have 500 basis points of rate cuts that they could do here to support the economy. The economy is holding up incredibly well despite this normalization in rates. And so from our point of view, you can actually look forward now with all of this stuff behind you and say, this could be a very long and sustained economic upcycle. Central banks have, I said, 500 basis points up their sleeve. They can use that to cut rates if the economy is slow. That ultimately means they can manage the economic cycle here for a long period of time from a position of extreme strength, which ultimately means we can go back to doing what we do best, which is just pick stocks. You know, we don't need to worry about these huge macro swings anymore. That's already happened. We ultimately can identify areas of structural growth like AI. And ultimately, these companies will just follow their earnings because their multiples are not going to move around, because interest rates aren't going to move around that much. And so from our point of view, this allows us just to lean into doing what we do best, which is to identify structural growth. That structural growth equals earnings growth, and that earnings growth equals share price growth. And that's really what we've been working on all year, to position the funds for this period. And if anything, it's come a little quicker than we thought.
So you did just tease at my next question. So you had mentioned earlier in the episode that ChatGPT launched in December 2022. So it's now been around for 12 months. What do you think the next 12 months looks like, and how are you capturing that from an investment point of view?
Yeah, and so this was obviously an important part of our decision to put cash back to work. And the reason why is because things like this don't happen very often, okay? So I've been doing this like 23 years, and I reckon this has only happened once before. From our point of view, this is the AI, you know, ChatGPT was the iPhone moment for AI. And so what do I mean when I say that? So everybody on this call probably remembers the first time they saw an iPhone or the first iPhone they got. And the iPhone was very clever because the internet was on your telephone prior to that, but it didn't work very well. But once you got the iPhone, the internet worked on your iPhone. And the reason why it worked well is because of apps. You know, Apple very cleverly created the app ecosystem. And suddenly there was an app for everything. There was an app for a map that could direct you. There was an app for music. There was an app for podcasts. There was an app that would track your run. There was an app that would help you find a date. Apps could pretty much do everything. And so the iPhone created infinite possibilities for the mobile economy, okay? ChatGPT or large language models will do exactly the same thing for AI. And so here at the end of, since it was launched basically a year ago, we're now a year into it, and there are already products coming to market that can do this. So Microsoft has launched Copilot products for all of their products, which ultimately would listen to a meeting and summarize it, would help predict what you're trying to type. Things like GitHub is helping predict what programmers want to write, and it makes them roughly 60% more efficient. Adobe has launched a product called Firefly, where rather than search for images, you can actually create an image with words. And Pinterest, which is, you know, a product where you would just used to look at pictures, say, that would appear in magazines, etc., you can now hover over those pictures and it'll actually tell you where to buy the products that the celebrities are wearing. And this is just people plugging generative AI models into existing products and making them better. And so we think this is effectively the same as your iPhone moment. You're effectively creating a step change in how AI works, where it used to just work for a few people and now it's going to work for everybody. And so from our point of view, this creates a plethora of opportunities. Most importantly, we think for the shovels in this boom are the main thing we focused on, which is mainly cloud computing companies. So to get these products to work, you're going to need a lot of data on the cloud. You're going to be able to want to use that data on the cloud. And so from that point of view, that's really a big win for the hyperscale cloud companies like Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. And then it's a huge win for software companies because software companies can now, they effectively have a new killer app to sell your own data back to you. And there, you know, we like ServiceNow, Intuit, Adobe, and some others that we're definitely looking at. And so, and if anything, we're just at the start of this. So these products are just getting launched. The uptake's just kicking in. And so from our point of view, this is a very exciting moment and one that we've definitely leaned into and we leaned into, as I said, in February, March, and we continue to lean into today.
And how does semiconductors play a part in this? And how does parallel processing affect generative AI?
Yeah, so I think this is probably the most exciting bit. We got the entire way through this podcast without him talking about NVIDIA. So here we go. This was the
can't do a podcast without talking about NVIDIA.
I'm yet to get through a meeting this year without having to talk about NVIDIA. Okay, so this was probably the most exciting thing that happened this year. So when you are doing generative AI, it's very different. So the reason why these models worked is ultimately because of this thing called parallel processing you mentioned, or because of accelerated computing. And so this is something that effectively NVIDIA invented a very, very long time ago. And they had this simple view that if you put a GPU or a graphics processing unit next to a CPU, you could accelerate the speed that these models work at. And the reason why this works is because a GPU has thousands of cores. It was mainly used for graphics in video games. You know, this is red, this is blue. But that's also quite helpful for saying this is a cat, this is a dog, that's a person, that's a pole. Making all these little iterative decisions that you need to get these models to work. And so this is called accelerated computing. NVIDIA has been at this for a long time, and all generative AI did was massively accelerate demand for their products. And so NVIDIA is obviously the success story of this year, where earnings are now, I think at the start of this year, we thought NVIDIA's data center business would do roughly $13 billion in revenue. And by the end of this year, it's actually going to do $62 billion. And so I've never seen that happen before. I've never seen a company grow at this scale at that size. This is not a mid cap. That's the seventh biggest company on the planet. So that just shows you how important this is. And so if you extend that further, now I'm not saying the demand for NVIDIA is going to keep going at that rate, and it might not, and you know, this is where the source of much questions you have. But if you extend that further, ultimately there's now a mad rush for the rest of the semiconductor industry to re-architect the way they make semiconductors the same way as NVIDIA does. And so that's these larger chips with the CPU, GPU, and memory all heterogeneously integrated onto the same chip. And so what we've done here when we're investing in high-performance computing, which is our biggest area as we go into 2024, we're basically saying exactly what I said to you before, is that we think AI is going to be big. We think the entire industry is going to shift their products to benefit from AI, which means also that the entire industry has to shift to these more parallel processing, these accelerated computing options. And so what that means is they're going to re-architect how they make semiconductors, not just for the data center, but also for your computer and for your iPhone. And so what we've done is not just invest in NVIDIA, but invest in the entire supply chain, because lots of people ask me, you know, is NVIDIA going to be the big winner here? We think it is, but it's not the only bet we're going to have. We're going to try and bet across the whole ecosystem, because we think this is the start of a 10-year change in the way we build these things. And And that's our job here, is to identify these areas of structural growth and identify the winners. And in many cases, we're looking at companies with very small market caps that we think just have tremendous opportunities in front of them. And so that's what we're doing when we're talking about semiconductors. And it's really just part of the same AI bet that I discussed with you earlier around software and cloud.
And so growth investing is not just tech. What other parts of the portfolio, what other areas of interest are you excited about for 2024?
Yeah, so as we go into 2024, the two bits I just spoke about being cloud and semiconductors, they make up roughly 40% of the portfolio today. So that's a big bet for us, but ultimately, you know, not the whole fund. The rest of the portfolio, what we've been doing this year, and it really comes back to the work that Charles's been doing around the smaller mid-cap fund, and the rest of the team's been working on this as well, is just to say, you know, what are the great companies that we always liked that we never got an opportunity to buy because we never were really happy with the valuation they traded at, or we just didn't think the risk reward was quite right. And ultimately just to say, you know, this valuation adjustment of rates going to 0 to 5 has given us this unique opportunity to find these companies that we've always admired. And there it's really in the internet space, it's companies like Uber, and Airbnb, which are companies that we've liked for a long time, but have ultimately had a lot of cheaply funded competitors that are now going to go away. That again is still tech, but as we move into consumer, it's things like Chipotle Mexican Grill in the United States, which for those here in Australia or elsewhere, or depending on the listeners, a bit like Guzman Gomez here in Australia, but other people around the world would be very familiar with Chipotle Mexican Grill. And ultimately Guzman is a copy of Chipotle. And to give you an example, Chipotle is a stock that was trading sort of 55 times earnings. We've always liked it, but then when we got the opportunity to buy it in the sort of 30s, you know, we took that. Another great consumer company that we've always admired, again, was trading at 55 times earnings, but has come back into the 20s, is Lululemon. We like Lululemon because we think they have an advantage in the quality of the products that they make. And it works for men as well as it does for women. And has a wonderful international rollout story. And another idea, you know, another opportunity, you know, and we've done that similarly with a company like, for instance, On Running. So On Running is, you know, this is, again, another good thing you can do at a time like this is there's a lot of companies that sort of IPO'd in 2021 or 2022 and, you know, just walked straight into a massive storm and everyone just didn't have time to look at it or couldn't cope with it. And On Running, for those of you who don't know, is a Swiss shoe company that you know, where Roger Federer is a shareholder and you know, it's sort of a high-end product, a bit like hopefully the next Lululemon. Now, Lululemon's obviously very established. On Running, we hope, can be like that. We're not sure, but you're again buying a company at a very small market cap, you know, with some good asymmetric upside if the team executes well and they are all founders in the business and they execute well. And the last one I'd mention would just be the stock we mentioned at Son this year, which was payments company Wise. Again, you know, IPO'd 2021, you know, stock halved, you know, it IPO'd at 60 times earnings. We're buying at 25 times earnings and it's the same company executing in the same way. So we just used this year to really identify some good risk reward opportunities in companies with smaller market caps or medium sized market caps where we think, you know, you've got that sort of potential to double your money over a 3 to 5 year time horizon if they can execute on a plan that they've had for a long time and ultimately they're still executing on their plan. It's just the equity market forgot about them for 2 years and now's going to remember them because interest rates are not really going to be pushing the markets around like they were.
So, Nick, we're running out of time, but I just want to know, is there anything that you would like to leave our listeners, any final sentiments before the year is out?
Yeah, so firstly, I just want to say to all our listeners and to all our investors or non-investors, thank you very much for your support throughout the year. The last couple of years have been a difficult period for growth investing. They have, you know, we've been running this business since 2016, but I was running money for 10 years prior to that. We have a 17-year track record of double-digit returns, but it's not a straight line. These periods happen. 2022 was without doubt, you know, one of the 5 bear markets I've been through in my lifetime, and I'd argue it was the second worst. Next to either the financial crisis or the dot-com meltdown, whichever one you want to choose. That was a bad bear market. It was a bad bear market that had a lot of potential to get worse this year in 2023, and thankfully it hasn't. What I would say to listeners today is we, you know, very thankful to be now sitting on the other side of that. Central banks have managed to navigate the inflation problem. Interest rates have peaked. And sure, while markets in the short term might get ahead of themselves, we should be at the start of a long upcycle. And that upcycle allows us to lean into our process and identify some of these big winners and, you know, basically do what we do best, which is to try and identify the areas of structural growth. That structural growth will equal structural earnings growth, and that earnings growth will equal share price growth. And that's your path to double-digit returns. And as I said today at the end of the year, happy to be on the other side of this and leaning into that and really looking forward to the years ahead and hopefully some improved returns for our clients.
Nick, I want to say not only thank you for sitting down and chatting with me today, but thank you for all your hard work over the last, you know, few years, but also this year. And I'm very excited for another great year ahead.
Thanks very much for having me, Taylor.
We hope you enjoy that episode. And to all of our listeners and investors, we just want to recap. Thank you for all of your support, and we hope that you have a healthy, safe, and happy holiday season.